Blog Talk Radio.
In the late 1700s, the founding fathers of the United States of America set out to create a nation that recognizes the natural state of the human condition rather than working against it. To quote Thomas Paine, "Independence is my happiness. I view things as they are, without regard to place or person. My country is the world, and my religion is to do good." Slightly predating this, in the mid to late 1600s, statutes for compulsory education were being established. Contrary to what modern political thinkers may want you to believe, some of our founding fathers were very much for a public education system. Thomas Jefferson was actually writing up drafts for public school requirements. One source that I'm getting this from is Notes in the State of Virginia, first published in 1785. And John Adams once said, quote, "The whole people must take upon themselves the education of the whole people and be willing to bear the expenses. There should be not a district of 1 mile square without a school in it, not funded by a charitable individual, but maintained at the public expense of the people themselves," unquote. It was understood by those forming or being part of the formation of a new country that for people to be engaged in a government of, for, and by the people, that they must have certain basic skills. To quote Jefferson, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free, in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and what never will be." Let us look at the sort of education that the founding fathers received. Many of our founding fathers received what is referred to as a classical education. Great thinkers who influenced the classical education were men of science, mathematics, linguistics, music, art, biology, as well as a philosophical worldview that attempts to see things as they are in nature, and that absolutism, morally speaking, is unnatural, and that the points of view have a subjective value according to the differences in perception. Or as I sometimes say, there are many realities. There is another common thread linking together the great classical thinkers: metaphysics. Aristotle refers to this as theological science. Pythagoras, before him, believed in ascension through philosophy. Pythagoreans believed in transmigration of the soul, this meaning that we reincarnate many, many times, ascending slowly as we learn and grow and hopefully progress. This is the life-after-death model that many modern pagans today have adopted, believe in, including myself. As natural as the changing of the seasons, spinning the wheel of the year, life, growth, death, rebirth. Many of our nation's early leaders would quote the classical Greek Roman works and scholars. Hamilton was said to be particularly fond of Plutarch. Of the 55 delegates of the Constitutional Convention, 30 of them were college graduates, and the others, some of the others, who did not graduate from a college, had an interest in the classical Greek and Roman pagan philosophers. The founding fathers were immersed in classical pagan thought. They wanted to study the ancients. They wanted to find examples of a country's ideas similar to their own visions, ones that were a success story. They were looking for past successes of similar visions to their own. The founders, the U.S. debated these ideas, pulling them from their readings of Polybius, Aristotle, and Cicero, the great orator. This evening, we will be discussing education, past, present, and future, especially for America. So I just thought it might be important for us to know what sort of education did the Founding Fathers have? And what is the importance of a classical education in modern times? What can be done to improve public schools, or private ones for that matter? What is our view on homeschooling and other forms of independent education that are independent of established traditional educational systems? What important role, if any, has pagan thought played in higher learning and in personal development? We will discuss these things and more tonight on a very special Sunday night edition of Maine.
The full moonlit nights, an infant cries in the great void of silence before we knew time. A miracle spawned the dawn of life. Hear all the stories of how we came to be, our legends, myths, and our hero themes that share the secrets of our cosmic seed.
Explode.
right, everybody. Hello and welcome to a special Sunday night edition of Main Street Universe, the show reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. And I don't know about you, but I can imagine a lot. Remember that we have an archive section, as all Blog Talk Radio shows do, which means that next week you can listen to last week, this week. In the archive section, just go to www.mainstreetuniverse.com, and it takes you to our archives. We've had some amazing guests on our show. We've had Kellyanna and Selena Fox, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus. We've had Mark Mandrake on the show before. We've had a lot of great commentators. Gunter Hauk was another great one, and many more that I can't remember. We're coming close to our one-year anniversary, and we might do a show commemorating that. And guess what? Just about on our one-year anniversary, Janice, like so many other days on the wheel of the year, this one falls on the day of Main Street Universe, our flagship show on Wednesday at 11 a.m., Samhain.
Yeah.
Falling right on the wheel of the year holidays for our flagship show, and we've been blessed to do our ritual. I think only one of them was a little off, and the rest of them were pretty much almost right there or right within that.
Born on Samhain.
Absolutely.
1993.
Yes. And soon will be joining us this evening, my brother, the Reverend Scott Samhain Michael. And let's go ahead. Our discussions about education, past, present, and future. It is as well about the connections between classical education and pagan thought. First, I would like to welcome from Chicago someone who is an artist and someone who is a writer, and he is chancellor of the Karelian nativist tradition. I would like to welcome Reverend Don Lewis. Hi, Karel. How are you, Reverend Don?
I'm very good. How are you tonight?
Very well, very well. And it's really a blessing to have you on this evening. It's great for you to join us in our discussion. And I do believe that you somewhat know my co-host, my hostess, Janice.
Yes, indeed.
How are you doing, Reverend Don?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine.
It's always good to get to talk to you.
Thank you, sir.
And you two know each other through the Temple of Isis, I believe, right?
Fellowship of Isis.
Oh, okay. Fellowship of Isis.
Yes.
And I'm going to go ahead, Reverend Don, and go ahead.
I was just saying, Fellowship of Isis is a wonderful organization.
Yes, it
and,
is.
And, yeah, very, very life-affirming, very positive.
All right, and I'm going to go ahead to our next guest. She's an author of two books. She has a background in education and works for an education nonprofit, I believe. And author Thea Sabin, her most recent book is Wicca for Beginners. We have a copy of it right here. And I'm sure this will allow us to talk about an aspect of education we'll bring up later, which is accessibility. Welcome, Thea Sabin.
Yes, welcome, Thea.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to hear your voice. We communicated through email a few times, and good to see that you're joining us in our conversation this evening. And I think I would like to start out with, if anybody remembers what now feels like 100 years ago, my introduction. It's funny. The only reason I say that is because sometimes you talk and then you talk something out and then you have a break from it and you've released it. Mm-hmm. And then it feels like, oh, what did I just say? That happens to me with tarot readings. I sometimes, after a reading, I really don't necessarily recall. I had a girl call me one time and say, this is just a friend, not for money. And it was involving having an affair. And she goes, oh, I had, yeah, you're right, I had an affair. And I had completely forgotten.
Feedback, yeah.
That we were talking about education, past, present, and future, and some of the connections between what is referred to as a classical education and with classical pagan thinkers and some of the great Greek thinkers like Aristotle, and one of my favorite, Pythagoras, who his followers definitely believed in what is referred to as transmigration of the soul, reincarnation in human form. And I did mention earlier Plutarch. I remember Reverend Don, in I think one of his lessons or videos, mentioned one of my favorite quotes, which is the difference between religion and superstition. And a religion is practices involving the love of spirit, where superstition is being afraid
of spirit. Yes.
And so, any comments, Reverend Don, on the history of America and classical education and paganism?
I think that a good classical education is a very valuable thing, something that's very, very rare today. One of the things I really like about the Fellowship of Isis is that Lady Olivia, who is the head of the fellowship, has a very broad classical education, and it shows in most of the things that she does. It's a very expansive way of thinking.
And I agree. I sort of had a basic standard American public school education, if you wish. I couldn't help but point to the floor because we have a cricket that sometimes joins us when we do this.
Yes.
And he just came out again. There's a cricket and a grasshopper.
Cricket we have. So.
And so the more I wasn't the greatest student as a kid. And the older I got, the more I began, after I left high school, the more I began to really respect the classical education people that had that gift or gave it to themselves later on. And there's a lot of things that tie in with pagan thought, with the great classical Greek philosophers. And I think one aspect that's very important is sort of relativism and looking at things as they are according to their situation versus absolutism, which is trying to take something and force it upon nature because you're saying, well, that's what I believe, so that's what it's going to be. And then trying to govern from that can be even
scarier.
Yeah, even more frightening. Not that I'm trying to make my show political, but it's okay to talk about political things, and we're all from different leadings here at Main Street Universe, our different hosts.
Things about a classical education that's really important to understand, because you're talking about the history of America, the history of the United States. And up until just a couple of generations ago, if you were an educated person, part of that was that you had a classical education. It was not something that occasionally went with higher education. It was part and parcel of it. So when we're talking about these people who were involved in the origins of the country, those who were educated came from that background. And even as little as 100 years ago, if you were educated, you still spoke Latin, and in many cases you still spoke classical Greek because it was part of the educational process, because you were expected to study those materials. And it really did inform how people think. The loss of that in the American education system, I think, is a lot of the problem that the origin of a lot of the problem we see with some of the things happening today in terms of polarization and extremely rigid worldviews, although certainly rigid worldviews are nothing new.
Sure.
Definitely not.
I agree. And on that point, you mentioned the Founding Fathers. Before I get to that, I'll comment on exactly what you said. The idea that helps, even if you don't actually speak Greek or Latin, but if you get the ideas that can come from the philosophies of these classical philosophers, is abstract thought. And this is something that I think that even in the modern world, if you're just getting started, this is where I think a pagan path can actually really help, because I think one of the great contributors of paganism, even in the modern sense, even brand new, is the open door to abstract thinking rather than absolutist thinking. A great example could just be go buy a tarot deck and start reading all the different little archetypes and what they mean. Sometimes we need to be the fool and be brave and jump off the mountain while our little dog or cat is trying to stop us. Sometimes we need to be more reserved, like the nine of wands reversed, and maybe it's not exactly time to go. But it's the idea of recognizing that we all have similarities. So bringing this abstract sort of thinking and combining it with the knowing that we all have things in common. So to me, a tarot deck is like all these little characteristics that we all have in common. And just doing that can help, even if it's not having the super classical education with the Greek and the Latin. And of course, in Greek, we did a show a while back with Mark Mandrick was our guest, and we talked about when people say that how the Bible is against gay marriage. Well, if you could translate from the old Greek, arsenikoites doesn't actually say, oh, this means man on man or woman on woman love. It meant something a little, actually quite different. It meant abusive behavior, or people that were abusive to slaves, people engaging in behavior that was oppressive to another person in a sexual way. Yeah, exactly. My brother's going to be joining us soon, and he'll definitely comment on some of that. So, yeah, promiscuity, bad behavior was arsenikoitis and malakos and a few others. So that could help people go, well, that's not really what the Bible says, if you're going to go into its actual old interpreting from Greek. Thea, I wanted to bring you into this a little bit. I do believe Thea Sabin is an author, and she's authored Wicca for Beginners. I believe that's your newest book, right, Thea?
Actually, you've got it the other way around. Wicca for Beginners was the first one, and Keeping Heaven.
She's had the teacher's manual as well.
Yeah.
Okay. And you have a background somewhat in education yourself, and I believe you work for an education nonprofit, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. A little bit of a complicated story, but yes, I was a high school English and theater teacher for a while, a master's in education, and then I worked in publishing for a bit and kind of came around full circle, and now I work for an organization that creates educational curricula for schools.
Okay, that's interesting. So, in your opinion, I thought, because you're working, we're going to take this to a little bit of a modern sensibility now. And we'll get back to the classical thing. Here are some numbers, Thea, that I came up with in my research. And that the graduation rate in the United States of America, the last recorded one I saw, was somewhere around 75%, which sounds not too bad, but there is then, 25% of people not graduating. And I'm also going to imagine that those are condensed to certain populations. That's exactly what I'm getting to next, Scott. And my brother asked, and how does that compare? Well, we rank 17th in science to the other major industrialized countries. We rank 25th in math, and we rank 14th in reading. So those really aren't great numbers.
No, they're pretty low.
The big superpower with all this money.
Everybody wants, or everybody claims.
In a recession, yes, but let's face it. And it's, what in your work, Thea, have you seen? Have you seen some positive tendencies going on, some positive workings going on to help better these numbers? And what do you think isn't working?
Good grief, we could talk about this for days.
Hey, we have an hour and a half.
Well, let me think for a minute. I have to say I've been kind of depressed by the state of what's going on. I mean, I think a lot of people have. It's a huge problem, and I don't hear a lot of what I hear is, you know, most of the solutions that presented sound to me as if they're very absolutist and they're very kind of the antithesis of a classical education, if you want to put it that way, not looking at the problem in an abstract way, but trying to pick out one thread or one purpose or one thing that's a problem. You know, person A says it's the teachers' unions, and person B says it's all the immigrants who don't speak English, and person C says the teachers are all lazy, and person D says the administrators are full of crap. You know, it's not that simple. It's just not that simple. The stuff that I work on is more around things like bullying. And one thing that I can say that's positive, that isn't academically related so much, well, tangentially it is that we're seeing a greater awareness of bullying education and kids learning about what that means and how to handle it and how not to do it. And one of the kind of core things that's really essential for a kid to do well in school, above and beyond whatever the crazy adults are doing around them, is a sense of well-being and safety. And so one of the things that we focus on is that. It builds the basis for academics. It also builds the basis for constructive criticism and conversation with others. If you're able to listen, you know, use active listening, which is really huge, and if you're able to pay attention to the teacher and whatever, all of these things are things that help you socially and also academically. And in those areas, I am seeing some hope and some growth. And of course, if you look at it academically, you can find success stories here and there too. It as much as people are looking at the problem in really kind of tunnel vision, they also kind of look at success and failure in tunnel vision. So I would love it if people could apply some of that lovely abstract thinking to this and look at it in a way that's more holistic and less blaming.
And I agree completely.
Yes.
The idea of approaching a subject by seeing it for what it naturally is, like the quote from Thomas Paine I said in the introduction. He says, I see things as they are in nature without regard to the person, place. And I think what he means by this is he's saying the situations are different because he even says later, the world is my country.
Mm-hmm.
My religion is to do good. And to me that means, you know, every situation could be different. There's a degree of truth that I think is undeniable in relativism that is not discussed on, say, right-wing radio.
Uh-huh.
Now, granted, I have Republican friends out there and some listeners, and some of them are very bright and very intelligent, so I'm not trying to bash anybody, but let's be honest, some of those talk shows are very much, and I have a lot of experience with this, folks, because I used to work construction, and I would work around that environment where these shows were on all the time, like in the background. And they're very angry. They're very polarizing. They've stepped away from polite conversation, and they've stepped away from looking at things in a natural or slightly abstract or slightly relative manner. So I do agree with you that it should be looked at more holistically. And Reverend Don, I remember one time I asked a legal question about politeness and was wondering if I romanticized the 70s. I used to think, were times just more laid back, were people just more laid back then? But maybe you could comment on politeness versus polarization, I thought.
I have to say it seems to me that I cannot remember a time more polarized than this, although, you know, things were pretty polarized in the 70s, too, and there have been a lot of times when that has happened, but it seems to me that at present it has gone farther than at any other time in my lifetime. I really think that it's a very, very bad thing, because when you polarize yourself that far and you demonize your opposition that badly, there is no way to get back to the center. And I don't even know what could bring people back to the center who are so polarized at this point, short of a great catharsis. Mm-hmm. And it would be nice to think that we could get a little bit closer to the center. I've certainly seen it happen at other times in my life, but it seems like people, particularly those who realize the power that can come through polarization, once they've picked it up, are just not willing to put it down. And certainly, you mentioned certain kinds of talk shows. The news today, compared to the news media of the 70s, is objectivity is virtually non-existent now.
And the
idea, the idea of journalism as a calling that was supposed to educate people and present them with actual information is effectively defunct in this country. It's not the first time, but, you know, it's the first time in my lifetime. And it seems to me there is no journalism going on now but yellow journalism. And this is not a good thing. It's not good for the country. It's not good for the people. It is, it's an ugly thing. And it could very easily lead to very ugly places, and has already in some cases. And I think it's a very unfortunate place to find ourselves. Now, I will say that when I was a child back in the late 60s and 70s, people were talking about revolution, and there were all kinds of things going on, so there was plenty of polarization then, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that it's worse now. It seems to me that the polarization then at least was more hopeful in what they wanted to see, whereas the polarization now only seems to want to see the destruction of the opposite side without any concern for consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as if both sides feel there is no room for the other.
Well, could I...
Scott St. Wormichael, by the way. He just joined us.
Yes. Yes, I just joined you.
Accotink Church, Burke, Virginia.
Yes.
Well, you know, there's been a whole host of things that have really just changed. And we've militarized our society, our civil society, in ways that it was never intended on being militarized. There is some decent journalism out there. I heard a great thing today on the drug war, listening to NPR, and how it started under the Nixon administration and really got amplified first under Reagan and then super amplified under Clinton, and then you had 9/11. We have a culture that puts more people behind bars than any other civilization, not only in the entire world today, but a higher percentage of its people in jail than any civilization in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And a large percentage of those are minorities, are non-whites, are poor. They're only in jail for really minor offenses, you know, being involved in the drug trade somehow. Is this the best use of our resources? Is should there be more young black men in jail than in college? I mean, I think the answer is pretty clear. No, it shouldn't be. And so why have we created an entire set of rules that has doomed an entire generation from even knowing its own role models? Because they're in jail. You know, their uncles and their fathers and, you know, their brothers are behind bars. And we've created this whole crazy thing. I mean, no wonder America has become less intelligent, because we've completely decimated entire classes of people, whether they're immigrants or poor non-whites or you know, gay people, whatever it is.
Right.
And I did want to add to that, Scott. My brother gets very passionate about money not being spent properly, not being spent on education. He's a teacher himself, and he's been a teacher before himself. And I did want to throw a couple numbers out there to complement Scott's point. And again, what we're talking about here is not necessarily angry political rhetoric. What we're talking about is, what do we think is important and what do we throw at it? And both philosophically and financially. And let me give you an example here. In California in the 1990s, they increased their jail funding by a whopping 209% while opening up one new university during the same period of time.
Mm.
In Philadelphia, there was Governor Corbett / education $1.1 billion while granting $650 million during this time to building new jails. There's a recent new one going up in Maryland now where I'm from. And during a recession, in the local Harford County where I spent much of my life and was raised, small county, $7 million for drug sniffing dogs. So the list goes on and on. I'm not trying to make this a polemic verbally about being, you know, against the war on drugs.
You're not making a polemic. You're just presenting the fact.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, the
yeah.
other fact is that the United States incarcerates a larger percentage of its people than any nation in the history of the world, including the Soviet Union and Maoist China.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, those are just facts. I mean, you can make of them what you will.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, now, people that listen to my show, they know I am for drugs. And to those that disagree in the audience, that's fine. But as far as the budget aspects, go ahead, Doc.
I think it's good to remember the line from The Legend of Peridor, which is, what are these things and who do they serve? And at
correct.
This point in U.S. history, prisons are a growth industry, and a lot of money is being made.
Good point.
And
yeah.
in some ways, the prison industrial complex has taken a lot of the role that used to be the military industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first thing one has to realize to understand why this is happening. The other thing, of course, is that because so many people are imprisoned and often lose their voting rights, it certainly serves the interests of certain political parties.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And go ahead, Janice.
Well, yes, if the, let's say, if a black man is in prison and he just gets out of prison and he doesn't have any ID, because I know that they're doing a big play about if you don't have any current ID, you can't vote. Now, I'm not going to say which state it is, and it's actually more than one state. But if you don't have any proper ID, you're not going to be allowed to vote, and you can pretty much guess whose party is sponsoring this. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about what Faya has said. I've never been a teacher, but I've been a social worker, and in some aspects, the social worker becomes the teacher or is supposed to be the teacher, the later teacher. But I had worked with children, pregnant teenagers, as well as the elderly. So I worked at, you know, four different generations. And what I have seen with what we, aspects of it with the schools, that there's a big cry about now getting rid of, like, say, the bad food or whatever, trying to ham it up with good food, and the kids aren't eating the food, or there's a lot of hunger. I grew up in Philadelphia, so I know a lot about Philadelphia, but I also lived in Baltimore, and I was also a social worker in Baltimore. And, you know, the Baltimore wants to say it has a lot of money through the Inner Harbor, through the different sports teams, but there's a huge section of Baltimore that is poor, black and Hispanic, low educated, low weight, because they're very malnutrition is in there because they're not getting enough to eat, and some areas that are really hidden war zones, that is in Baltimore, Maryland. Like, I stayed on basically St. Paul Street. That was in between a very good section in some instances, but it could be carded.
You were north of 25th Street?
Yes.
Yeah, I know Baltimore really well.
Oh, okay, yes.
It doesn't get much more real than this, folks. It doesn't get too much more real than this. My brother Scott here, Scott Samuel Michael, Reverend Scott, he taught in a Baltimore City middle school, and we all know how middle school kids can be.
Okay.
And,
you know, Middle school is an amazing time, though. You know, if you can be a good teacher in middle school, you are an excellent teacher.
I don't know how good I was. I had an awful principal.
No.
I was in a place called Lakeland Middle School in South Baltimore, in that little sort of ribbon of land below the Patapsco River, which is mostly forgot about. Not far from there is the Fairfield dump.
Yes.
The waste, and there were three neighborhoods near us. They were all really difficult neighborhoods. But the neighborhood, the school was in Lakeland, was a nice neighborhood. It was, you know, mixed racially, mixed economic. I mean, there was no really, really wealthy people there, but, you know, there was middle class down to working poor and, you know, a couple of really destitute families. But most people were intact. Most families were intact. But then they would bus the kids in from Cherry Hill and Mount Washington.
Oh, Cherry Hill is no joke.
And you know, it only takes one knucklehead to ruin a class, you know. Especially if he or she's pretty creative, and so it was difficult to teach, and you know I got no support from my principal, I got no support from my department chair who was nearing retirement, so she actually took 100 days off my first year of teaching, you know, so I had no support. It was just, and I really was, you know, I was devoted. I wanted, you know, I didn't miss a day. That
or
year,
the parents,
you know. Well, the parents were interesting.
Okay.
Because it was a mixed neighborhood, and there were some parents who were a little more concerned about race than others. And I was one of the few white male teachers in that school, and some of the white families really, you know, identify with me. But back then I was married to another woman than whom I'm married now, and she was African American. And when they found out I was married to an African American woman in December, I actually had this one woman come into my office and say, "I don't want you giving your ideas to my daughter." Right? You know, I'm like, I'm teaching English. You know, I'm teaching her how to.
Hello.
I'm teaching her how to conjugate verbs. You know, and what ideas are you talking about?
It was
right there. I mean, you know, I had some kid, you know, who was related. Do you remember the name Dante Carter from back then?
Yes.
He was somebody who was convicted of murder. I had his younger brother. I didn't even realize Shamari. I'm disguising his name. I wouldn't use his real name.
Right.
But he was a tough kid, and I came down hard on him. And after he got expelled, one of the other kids was like, "You might not want to come down so hard on Shamari." You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, I was in a strange place where it was difficult to teach. I did everything I could, and you know, some of the other teachers, they hated me, you know, because I worked hard and I cared, and I wasn't willing to take the nonsense of the system. And you know, I mean, it's just in the way I was, and I couldn't stand it. I guess I could have, you know, the honorable thing to have done is probably stayed in the system and tried to change it, but I just felt like there was so much against me. I left and started working as an electrician.
Mm-hmm.
Like all the Michaels.
Yes.
Go ahead, Thea.
Oh, I was just saying, one thing I kind of want to throw out there, sort of relating back to the whole classical education thing, but also to... Mm-hmm. You know, school climate and creating an environment that where kids can actually learn and helping to solve some of the problems that we have now. You know, they don't teach civics anymore.
They don't teach what?
Civics.
They don't teach civics anymore.
How you are responsible to your society and your society is responsible to you. How you as a human being interact.
Still there?
Sorry, my brother dropped him.
Sorry about that.
Go ahead, Thea.
Yeah. No, how you as a human being interact and are responsible to and society. And I honestly think that's one of those kind of meta things that help kids, regardless of their situation, you know, ask some really good questions about where they belong and what they're doing. And I don't see any of that anymore in the schools at all.
No, they don't have that there. But, you know, they're trying to get rid of pretty much everything in school. I know there's a thing about, you know, they don't want to have gym class because they don't want to...
Music.
They don't want people that are heavy to feel isolated in gym class. So let's get rid of gym class. Let's get rid of arts and music, which I love music. I'm a radio producer. I produce my own reggae show. And, you know, I have a lot of people come up to me and, like, I love what you're playing. And you play old school as well as new school, or what they call old school as well as new school. And, you know, they're talking about getting rid of music, which is something that I always had, because when I was in school, I used to play on the band. And you know, we weren't the Jackson 5 by any means, trust me. But we did good with music. We love music, and it's feeding us in our adult lives. And you want the schools to get rid of arts and music. Then, you know, what other things are they going to get rid of?
And I want to comment on that, too, because that's always, every single time they talk about a budget cut, the first thing on the chopping block is they say music. They always want to cut back music. And I've even seen on some of these shows people saying, oh, there are studies that music increases intelligence. And I won't say the name of this talk show host. And he was saying, oh, no, it doesn't, ladies and gentlemen, and ruffling his papers. And in truth is, scientific research does say that music does help with certain forms of intelligences. And it helps with spatial temporal reasoning, and I think the linguistic side. It was misinterpreted by some. But when I was a kid, I remember being in school, and it looks like my brother wants to say something, and people from Europe were coming to tour our schools for whatever reason. I don't remember. I was in middle school. And I remember them hearing them talk in the halls, in the principal going, so what do you think? And I remember every single one of them was like a group of like 10 people, all from different European countries, or maybe some of them from the same whatever. And all of them said, you know, they were like, it seems like a very small music program here. Where is the music? You know, and it seemed like they were all concerned about this. And Scott, maybe you can comment as a longtime musician, the connection between music and intelligence and the importance of it and discipline and everything else.
For most people, there is a direct connection between being able at least to understand music as a listener, if not to play it as a musician, and the development of their highest potential intellectually and in other ways. Anytime you do something like music that engages the body in something that is both artistic and rational, as music is both, and then you add vocal music on top of that where you're dealing with concepts and words and ideas, you know, it has to create a more complete human being and a more powerful intellect. I mean, you know, you never know the joy of a muscle unless you exercise it, right? So if you don't exercise your brain or most of the brain that you can, you're never actually going to have any sense of what your real potential is. So music, you know, one of the most important things about learning, and, you know, I have a lot of experience with classical education, going to St. John's College Annapolis, where the Great Books program is the program. You don't major in anything but the program. And, you know, so you read all the classics in their own languages if you can, but my language skills weren't that good, But so, you know, I understand that learning is not just rational, even though I have that learning. You know, I mean, there's a great quote I have here from Joseph Campbell, you know, we need more poetry that reveals what the heart is ready to recognize.
Oh, yeah.
Sadly, too much education thinks it's just about the facts. It's just about learning procedures to operate machinery or skills to pass certain tests. It doesn't teach people to think. It doesn't teach people abstract reasoning. It doesn't teach people that there is a divine and integral connection between mind, body, spirit. And when music, you're taking all that stuff and then you express it with your body, whether you're playing the music or dancing or just swaying to it, it changes you.
Yes, I agree with.
Yeah, it's insane. And the other interesting thing that I think of when I think about classical education is, you know, there really are only so many supremely important, divine and eternal, modes of investigation. And, you know, until you figure out what all of the great thinkers before you have had to say, okay, you can't do all of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, until you realize that there's a whole body of learning that of all these amazing people who have encountered the same things that have occurred to you, you know, how can you begin to think that you can have the most powerful thing you can say?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm just trying to get back to classical education.
It's a great point, and I'm glad you wrapped it up. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take a brief break because I'm going to change the flow of this a little bit with a very, very, very brief song. And then when we come back, I'm going to change the direction a little bit of the conversation, and it will incorporate the two guests on the phone, Reverend Don Lewis, High Corel, Chancellor of the Corellian Tradition, and author Thea Sabin. And of course, the rest of us as well, but we're all here in person. So I'm going to go ahead, and this song is a very brief percussion piece. And it'll be Tom Heasley. And this one is really nice, and it's called Nights Over Baghdad. We'll come back just briefly. It'll only be a minute or so. We'll catch a breath. And then I have a few questions very specific to the type of work that Thea Sabin and Reverend Don Lewis High Corel are involved in their daily lives. And we'll bring on another caller that's there too as well. There's folks on the phone. And here we go. This song is Nights Over Baghdad. Yes, our cricket has joined us.
Yes, the cricket is singing too.
They're talking about you.
Tom Teasley is a friend of mine and a friend of the show's, and he is someone whose job, which is a pretty sweet gig, drummer for the State Department. Wish I had my cymbals in here, because sometimes when I pause to do like a dramatic point, I'm not in the studio tonight, folks, we're in the basement of the house, and I would like to... Reverend Don, I'll start with you. I want to talk about a subject that's coming been coming up a lot recently, both in, I think, your circles and as well as my own personal pagan circles. I've been in a lot of debates and discussions with people in my own life, and also I've seen in your world as well, at Witch School and other places, and that is the idea of accessibility and the importance of accessibility. Because in my opinion, accessibility is amazingly important, because new students to anything, and let's say in this case we're talking about paganism or Wicca, and the real students are going to stay anyway, and the ones that don't want to stay will leave. So some people argue, oh, it shouldn't be too easy and too accessible. I say it should be easy and accessible in order to build a strong community, and that, you know, the ones that the dedicated ones will become that eventually. I just thought maybe you could comment, Reverend Don, on the nature of accessibility in education.
Well, the first thing I would say about that, which applies to a lot of the things that have been discussed this evening, is that one of the worst mistakes that people make is they confuse form for function.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that you approach, your question has to be, what is my desired outcome? And the form that you give it must then be the one most likely to take you to that outcome. If you start with the question, what is my desired form, you're going to have problems. By focusing on the outcome, by focusing on what you're trying to get, you're going to have a lot more success. And in terms of accessibility, for me, accessibility is very much part of that question.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that a lot of people object to accessibility because they think that the door should be open just a little crack so only the best people get in. But the truth is, the best people don't do that.
No.
In order to get the best people, I find you have to go through about 100 people to get one who's going to be really good. And you have to go through more than that to get one who's really going to do a lot. If you don't go through that 100 people, you're not going to get that one. Now, those other 100 people may still play a very important role, but many of them will also fall away. But if the door isn't open enough to let through enough people, you can't really find the good people in the first place. So the argument that you should not have your door wide open really is a self-defeating one. It presupposes that really excellent people are the only ones who are going to go through that door, whereas the truth is, the way that people often try to run their organizations, the ones who get through the door, when they're trying to be exclusive that way, are often just the ones who are most determined, by no means necessarily the best.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up having most of the same problems anyway.
Mm-hmm.
When you're extremely accessible, you get all kinds of people, and they often do bring all kinds of problems. But you also do get those better people who are going to be very active.
Yes.
And I've heard a lot of people make that argument that they don't want to deal with anyone who's not worthy. But I've rarely seen them dealing with all that many people who are really all that great.
What is considered worthy, though, really?
Whoever can get along with them, usually. Their criteria is usually extremely subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've found is that every person can find a place where they can be good for their organization or their movement if they wish to be.
Mm-hmm.
And all kinds of talents and abilities have a place. There
mm-hmm.
isn't a single cookie cutter that we need to have. And many of the people I have found most useful are people who had talents I would not necessarily have even thought to look for until I saw them.
Mm-hmm.
And so from the point of view of someone running an organization, accessibility to what you're offering is important just to get the people. It's not just the benefit to them, it's the benefit to you as well. Now, the benefit to them, speaking in the context of paganism, we are, in a lot of ways, an embattled movement. Not as much as we once were, but we still are. And there are a lot of people who would dearly love to take away our freedom to be as public as we are. There's just been a very highly celebrated controversial decision in Canada to make all prison chaplains, basically to let go of all of their non-Christian chaplains for the most part, although it was their part-time chaplains they let go of. It just had that effect.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that a lot of pagans and other people, too, are making is that the idea of having a chaplain who is a Christian, who then ministers to all these other religions, it's not really a very good idea for those other religions. But there's not much they can do about it because they don't have the numbers, they don't have the influence, they don't even have the arguments because they don't have the accessibility.
Right.
There are a lot of people
in prison
setting
as well.
Yeah.
And could I say on a slight positive, Reverend Don, and I'll let you continue, that on that note is, it was over on Zell, I remember one time, I was on his show or listening to it, and he mentioned that in California, where some of this issue about prison ministry was going on,
mm-hmm.
one of the things was the lowest prison populations were pagan and Hindu. So they seemed to be sort of underrepresented. So in a way, that's good news that it seemed as if people that identified themselves as either Hindu or pagan in general were of the lowest of the prison populations, the highest being, I think, Catholic and Muslim, if I remember correctly. And I remember Oberon Zell saying, what an interesting fact. What a thing to explore. Why is that? Is that good news? Is it percentage-based? Not really sure exactly. But
well,
go on.
In a sense, I suppose that's a good thing. But, of course, the reason that we should be one of the lowest populations in prison is that we're one of the lowest populations out of prison.
Right.
It would be
yeah.
amazing if it were otherwise.
And my point was, I'm not sure if this was percentage-based or not, like just based on this, but go ahead. I understand what you're saying.
Hmm. And there are all kinds of things we could get into with that question.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to accessibility,
yes.
I'm put in mind of the Pentacle Quest for the Pentacle grave markers. One of the reasons that was able to go forward as well as it was that they opened it as much as they could to the wider population
mm-hmm.
to enlist support. And it was presented, and I was involved with this, it was presented as a veterans' rights issue rather than a pagans' rights issue. These veterans just happened to be pagan. They got a lot more support by being open and accessible in that way.
Mm-hmm. You mean Abe Kuman?
Really made a difference.
The one that Selena Fox had did a couple years ago, trying to get markers for, I think, Roberta Stewart's husband and Ave Kuman, who Rosemary used to live outside of Baltimore, and I became very good friends with Rosemary when she was alive. And I think a couple other veterans that the Pinnacle markers were involved with.
Yeah.
But from a pagan point of view on the subject of accessibility,
yes.
these things aren't going to happen without numbers and support.
Mm-hmm.
And this inaccessible model is great if you want to be a second or third class citizen and don't want to be open about your religion and your practices and don't want to have the legal freedom to have them. But if you do want those things, accessibility is a really good idea. And in the end, I think that's, for the pagan movement, the biggest argument for accessibility. That
and I agree completely. I know people, some of them very intelligent people, some of them very intelligent pagans, that some of the ones I know don't necessarily think it should be not accessible, but they think it should only be for, like, well, the special few that know where to find this and that and da 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 da. And some of them exist on different levels. You know, it's not all absolute. I mean, some exist on different levels. And I understand some of those arguments, but my whole point has always been that if you make it easily accessible and you do an open door approach, with still some, you know, maybe initiation, but you do an open door approach, that the people that are going to be the real deal are going to stick around, and the ones that are, it's just a fad, they're going to leave anyway. So you're still going to filter out those that aren't going to be all that interested in it. It's a fad for them, and there's nothing wrong with that. I have nothing against people that they say, oh, I'm a witch as a fad. They like to play dress up and go to tea party things with the hats or whatever. Whatever. I have no issue with that.
Well, the only thing that
is an issue to me is when people are so closed off to the point where they're insulting to those traditions that just at least open their doors a little bit. But I actually think some of that is getting much better. I think, now, I could be wrong. This is from my experiences. In my experiences in recent times on different places in online pagan community, at least, which was the only time I ever got the rudeness, it seems to be much a little bit more polite now than it was. And the ones that are impolite are so ridiculous, they just look like obvious trolls. There was a couple years back, it seemed to be really bad. There seemed to be a lot of venom going around and people enjoying the sort of jumping, sort of bullying, you know, a bit of bullying going
on. Those were the special people who were worthy of being let in.
Yeah. And
that's an important thing to remember.
Yeah.
Those are the people that those very exclusive elitist types thought were worthy of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're always from that closed end of the community. But go ahead.
And if they are so special and they are so great, then to me, their character doesn't show me someone that represents their tradition well.
Mm-hmm.
And or at least if they're, some of them are even pretending. And I have a couple things I do want to mention. Janice, I think she's going to be leaving in about...
Yeah, I'm going to be leaving in 10 minutes.
And
Reverend Don, I didn't get to ask you any questions. I'm sorry.
No, there's still time for you to ask.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and do now. We're going to take a breath. We've talked about some things. And I will like to end it with, I actually think the pagan community, Reverend Don, you can agree or disagree, I think it's starting to get slightly more polite now online than it was, say, a few years ago in Wiccan Together and other real pagans in some places where it was outright brutal for a while. I think it's getting a little better progress. And Janice,
I think that's true, and I think it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, to me, I think it's getting a little better in person as well. Because when I started in 1993, it was really brutal for a person of color. And, I mean...
I know we don't have pictures out there, but
okay.
We talked about mixed marriage and stuff. It's a mixed show, I guess, if you want to say. Janice is of Haitian descent, right?
Yes.
Haitian African-American woman descent. And of course, I am Irish and French. And so I just wanted to get that out there for those, because I know there's not pictures of us. But go ahead, Janice.
Okay. It was really brutal for me, and it took me a while. One of the things that I really like about the Fellowship of Isis is when I started with them, which I think was about 97, 98, in Chicago, FOI Chicago, they were very open-door friendly with me. And where a lot of other organizations were not, because not only being a woman of color, a woman whose magical in play has a lot of different doors, if you know what I'm saying. But I think it's definitely getting better online. And even though I haven't really had too much shocking things online, I have more in-your-face shocking things, but I have also seen the rise and fall of inappropriate material and inappropriate talking and emails in the past that seem to be cleaned up now. Reverend Don?
Right.
Yeah.
And two things. One is I'm going to go ahead and bring on a caller, and it is, I believe, our friend, my former co-host of Main Street Universe, Kevin Baird. Are you there, Kevin?
I am. Can you hear
Sorry
me?
Sorry it took that long.
Yep, no worries.
Kevin is the host of our – we're actually now a network of four shows, Main Street Universe, with me and Janice. Zarayana Radio with Evan Paz is a great myth lorist. He's sort of our Joseph Campbell. He lived in India for a while and studied under a Brahmin and is very young and very wise for his young age. I certainly was not spiritually wise. There's also, at that age, he's like 24, 23. I've been blessed to know a lot of smart young people, you know, in my recent time. And, of course, Kevin Baird, Walking on the Horizon, Walking on the Sidewalk, Horizon Oracle Journeys, and Jesse Ann Nichols, George, is at midnight on Friday, and Kevin's is at, it's at 9 on Friday night, right, Kevin?
Nope, I moved it to 5 p.m.
Oh, that's right, because we don't compete with Pagans tonight. That's one thing, Don, that we do not do. None of our Main Street Universe shows are on that same time, at least for the current schedule, as Pagans Tonight. It's kind of a little thing I told Ed and said I want us to complement each other and not compete. So as far as for the current schedules, all of our shows are not on at the same time as Pagans Tonight shows are.
But also for the 5 p.m. show, it makes it possible for the people in the U.K. to be able to listen without having to be up past midnight.
And Kevin, I believe you at one time met Reverend Don.
Yes, we had the chance to talk when we were up. I was up in the museum visiting Salem and everything, and I got to have a tour of the museum. It was a great time, and Reverend Don and I had a chance to talk about some of the concepts that I was working on, and he shared with me the stuff that was going on with the museum. So, Reverend Don, again in voice, it's good to connect with you, sir, and, you know, greetings and blessings.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you as well.
But I wanted to add, you know, with what we're talking about tonight, is like, what is the intent of the spiritual journey, like, that we're all on? And my belief, my realization is evolution. Like, we want to be better on an evolutionary scale spiritually than what we were yesterday or a year ago or something like that. But the thing is that I feel like we are at a second genesis of what Atlantis went through. We're at the second genesis of Atlantis, where the Atlanteans, who had absolute understanding of what was clear and what was not, and that they were in a deluge, they were overwhelmed by those who were uneducated, did not have the, you know, the awareness, the constitution that made it possible for them to, you know, mark their place in their evolution as well, and that they just ended up being sort of like a statistic. And that I think the Atlanteans ages ago realized that, you know, evolution and education and wisdom can only get to a certain point, and then it eventually turns into sort of like a downward spiral into diminishing returns. And with the way that the educational system is going, people are knowing less, there's no money going into funding in the educational system. Those people who really want to know more and have an ambition to know more really have to run on their own gas, their own energy, their own ambition to really grasp, you know, to a new level of understanding. And everybody else that's out there is basically what some people refer to as sheeple. And Reverend Don, I was wondering, what is your opinion on that? Are we at a place to where a society is locked into the video game world and that they're in some kind of matrix that there's no hope of escape from? We're getting in a diminishing return, and eventually it's going to crash. And only those who are of the gifted are going to sort of like disappear into some kind of woodwork or landscape that's not accessible by anybody else. What is your opinion on that?
Well, the first thing I would say is that there's always hope as long as people as long as people are still willing to attempt to bring about the things they want, no matter what the circumstances are. The second
right.
thing, you mentioned people who wanted to learn and grow having to work under their own power. This is always the case. And to be honest, the foundation of a good education really is knowing how to think. And it is probably, if we really wanted to improve general education, teaching people how to think rather than merely learning facts and figures and so forth would be the most valuable thing we can do, because when you know how to think, you know how to learn whatever you need to learn as long as you have access to information. And never before in human history have more people had access to information than they do now.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about education, and, you know, it's... and. People always seem to focus on the negative, and that is partly because as humans we try to be problem solvers. But I don't think there's ever been a time when as many people have been as educated as is the case today. There certainly has never been a time when people had greater access to information, and although there are certain things we might like to see improved or changed, it certainly isn't because there are fewer educated people today than, say, the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to look back to my grandparents' generation, which would be the 1920s,
mm-hmm.
you would find that the vast majority of people didn't even graduate high school. They also, in many cases, didn't need to, because it wasn't necessarily required for the lives that they were pursuing. Graduates from college, much, much smaller than today by far. Huge numbers of people, as I say, didn't even graduate high school because it wasn't necessarily regarded as a necessity, and in many cases wasn't. Today, if you've not graduated high school, it's considered shocking. It was not at that time. This is a huge change in the advance of public education. And I think people sometimes forget how far we've actually come from where we were.
Yeah.
And I think that, so I'd say if you know how to think, you can educate yourself on any subject. It's certainly possible to get access to information on virtually any subject today, although not always equally good information, but that's where knowing how to think comes in again. If you can ask yourself the questions, if you can ask yourself reasonable questions about the material you encounter, you can often determine whether it's really useful to you or not. There is no greater enemy, in my opinion, to education than merely passively absorbing facts and figures, because you know, that's just memorization. It isn't really being educated.
Well, I was working with my niece earlier last week, I guess, and the teacher sent home some homework that gave her one of the lessons, or one of the questions was, would you rather live in the time of the mound builders? And I'm in Ohio, and this is a place known for mound builders back maybe 2,000-3,000 years ago, up to like maybe 500 years ago, or would you rather live now? And she's only 9 years old, and they asked her this question. It's like, would you rather live in present-day society, or would you rather live in the mound builder society, and why would that be? Why would you want to live in present-day society instead of mound builder society? I'm like, this child, 9 years old, there's no way that she can have a concept about understanding the thinking of a mound builder versus someone who watches, you know, being a Kardashian or wanting to be like a Kardashian or something. And I wanted to sit down with her for like a day and walk her through, you know, like the the origins of the pyramids and everything, and what people had to go through, and Native American-esque kind of stuff. And her mom is like, no, she just needs to have a basic understanding of this. Don't take her any further into that. And me looking at this, it's like she has to have a concept of an understanding for what and who the mound builders were, so she can give a valid answer to what the teacher was asking. And this child, only 9 years old, I'm overwhelmed. Not really overwhelmed.
I wanted to comment on that. There's this thing of, Kevin, I'm sorry. I was saying there's this thing of, there is a debate in the pagan world and in the magical world as to when to start training people in the world of magic and divination and all these things. Some would say it's around the age of 13, I think, is the age that some people think. But I wonder if Reverend Dunn or Thea Sabin, who's still there on the line, I know she hasn't said anything in a while, maybe has an opinion on this, one of the two callers on the line. I would say we'll start with Reverend Dunn. Your opinion of when is a good time to start training a child that maybe looks like they have the gift?
Well, 13 has been considered rather a traditional number in my background, although education could start earlier. I don't see any reason that education, certainly about other times and places, could not start much earlier. Mine certainly did. I can't really remember a time when things like mythology and information about the ancient world were not part of my life. And I myself was initiated at the age of 13, and so I come from that kind of background. And so I will tell you that there is no inherent reason that it's a problem. That's not to say that everyone should have that background, but I certainly do not consider it inappropriate. There was an essay once written about witch school, which started out by complaining about a 16-year-old priest as if it were the worst thing in the world. But, you know, I would have been that person because at that age I was certainly already at that stage. And so to me it seems perfectly natural. And that's one of the reasons why we have been very open to early learning. I do think that if you were to start formal magical training at like 6 or 7, that would be too young. But informal training is another matter, and I've known many people who will do that.
Or just scholarly, like in a scholarly form, like you say, informal. And real quick, Reverend Don, someone like to say goodbye?
I'm sorry I didn't get to actually ask you questions about Carillion. I guess that's the next radio show.
You're very good. It's good to talk to you.
It's very good to talk to you, too, Reverend Don.
So, I look forward to seeing you again sometime.
Yes, I do, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. And good night, Janice.
Good night.
And Dave, is it?
Dave.
Oh, awesome. Great to meet. Yeah. And great for Janice. I'm so glad she's on our show now. She's a great hostess. Anyway, she had to go. And Thea Sabin, I'm sure you're still on the line there. I know a lot of people have been talking. It's now down to me, Reverend Don, Thea Sabin, and I think maybe my brother, if he's over there on the phone. And Thea, I'm wondering about your comments about accessibility, because you wrote a book that was very accessible, Wicca for Beginners. And I agree with the idea of accessibility.
You know, I it's funny, when you first said accessibility, the first thing that always comes into my head right now, because I'm building, you know, a 1,000-plus page website, is web accessibility, which is a whole different ball of wax. But
right.
Yeah, and you know, then my brain went to accessibility in terms of folks with learning disability and English language learners and that sort of thing, which is the second place my head usually goes with that word. And that, of course, can pertain to the pagan community as well. The Wicca for Beginners book, I deliberately, like you said, started from something super basic and just tried to build the information, like each chapter on the one before it, precisely because of accessibility. I tried not to sell any particular kind of Wicca. I tried not to make one thing look too much better than another. You know,
right.
One thing is really important, and touching on some of the stuff that Alan was talking about, to me when I'm teaching pagans, Wiccans, is critical thinking. You know, don't just parrot back what I say to you. I want you to think about it. I want this to be your answer. I want you to own it. I want you to explore what you think. And accessibility to me, in part, means giving folks the space to do that and the framework to do that. And people do that in very, very different ways, depending on their backgrounds, depending on their age, depending on their learning style. You know, so, as a teacher, keeping a flexibility and an openness and really paying attention to ways that you can help folks get at that kind of stuff, to me, is a form of accessibility.
And I agree. The idea of accessibility, to me, again, comes to a very basic education idea that, in my opinion, in a modern sense, that does speak to me is this. And that is that sometimes people in certain parts of their lives aren't naturally bright students and aren't naturally great at this or that and aren't naturally great at the classroom model and et cetera, et cetera. So if they find something a little bit more accessible, a little bit more simple, and I don't mean simple in an insulting way, I just mean simple in an open door way, then they can take it upon themselves as they begin to study to become more advanced and to use the example of pagan studies. I think Reverend Don with Witch School and your book are classic examples. I found Reverend Don's books to be amazingly accessible and as well, in some ways, with very interesting detailed information, but they had a great outline to them. Here are the lessons. Here's what happens each time. The outlines are there. And you take it and you do with it what you want. You know, it's up to you after this point. I'm not going to chase after you. I hear that sometimes from pagan teachers, and I almost get that impression from the book. I get the impression, like, say, for example, Reverend Don, when I read the first degree book or watch the videos, that it's, here it is. I'm opening the door. And now you can take it, you know, beyond if you want, because there's so many fascinating eclectic and traditional and whatever forms of paganism study, but you're giving them an awesome, in my opinion, an amazingly well done, outlined, structured, outlined, accessible book. Your Witch School degree books, I think, are great.
Thank you.
Especially the first one is just a great open door. So I think you did a very good job on that, and I'm curious on your comments about what is the importance of secrecy. And so my whole point is, how can a community grow when it is secret? So,
well, I'm not a great fan of secrecy. I think it's overall a destructive thing. There are a few exceptions. The exact ritual of an initiation, for example, I tend to think should be kept secret, because that way it's fresh for every person.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not because I think it's something that would be wrong to share, but rather because I think it would diminish the person's experience. But in general, I am not a fan of secrecy. I think it's extremely destructive to our future. There are very few things that we have any need to keep secret, because there's very little that we have in our community that you can't find in somebody's book somewhere.
True.
So a lot of people are doing all kinds of gyrations over secrecy of things that have been published for generations.
Yes.
And even if that were not the case, there's a famous saying And I do not remember off the top of my head where it comes from, but it's from a prominent leader of an earlier generation that we must constantly guard the secret. We must carefully guard the secrets by revealing them constantly. And
right.
You know, secrecy for the most part. Well, going back to form and function, it plays little real function in building anything good that we need at this time.
Yes.
It isolates us, it encourages and protects bad behavior, it encourages anything but high standards, because you can hide everything behind your secrecy and never really have to deal with the outcome. And I think that for the most part, secrecy is our enemy and is something we should work hard to reduce, except from perhaps the very few places where it does serve a legitimate function. There are not many.
There are certain places.
I think that it has kept in power a lot of people who should not have been in power, especially in local communities, and I think that it's made a lot of mischief possible that should never have occurred. And you were talking earlier about all of the emotional violence that our community has seen. You were referring to online emotional violence, but it's been just as bad in many real-time communities, many of which are in ruins because of it. Now, a lot of that could have been avoided if we weren't so secretive.
I agree. Because some people valued just the secrecy itself, rather than the value of their own tradition itself. And to
Yeah, the other thing, when somebody looks at someone who's being highly secretive, their first question is, what are you hiding or what are you ashamed of?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not hiding anything.
Right.
And therefore, I see no need to be highly secretive. If we were to go back a couple of generations when there was a higher level of prejudice, I could see it a little more, but it's the very fact that people have dedicated themselves to not being secretive that has brought down the level of prejudice, because people have seen what we're about. And I think that secrecy breeds a huge number of problems.
It does. I will comment on one of them, and Thea Sabin, I think, is of the, though I'm sure she's young and beautiful still, but is of the age to remember this. I'm just thinking. We all remember the 1980s and what is called the Satanic Panic. You were pagan then, or even if you weren't and you were just looking at that, it was a very strange, unusual time, and my mother totally bought into that. And I was not gathering with a group of people, but I used to go talk to a local old lady. You've probably heard me mention her before. I would say maybe she was more spiritualist than a witch, but she did use the word witch, but she talked about a lot about spiritual law. And, of course, my mom might listen to this, so I got to be careful. And she's still alive, and I love her, but she's not exactly a fan of my choice and path. And I used to sometimes, you know, get together with this old lady, and it was at that time of the Satanic Panic, 80s. It was in about 87, I think, 86 when I met her. She just had lots of great information that slowly leaked as she leaked in and out of reality. She was always talking to spirits and ghosts, and she was dying, and she knew she was dying. She was very much at peace with the fact that when she talked to me and was teaching me certain witchy lessons, that she was going to drift out and be talking to somebody else. It was a very interesting experience. But what I'm saying is, and my point is on this, is the perceptions of the Satanic Panic 80s came about, of course, because there weren't enough people standing up and just saying what is and what isn't. And so decent people were being, you know, in some cases persecuted and, you know, criminalized and everything else that were completely innocent.
I mean, people went to jail for stuff or were fined heavily. I remember cases of people saying, oh, we've uncovered through hypnosis the satanic cults and all of this, and then they try to tie them into everything else and tie them into, oh, it's pagans and everything else. So, anyway, if you know that era, you know what I'm talking about. And just good, accessible, solid, a few good, solid, accessible teachers that were in the mainstream could have helped, you know, calm that down. Not regretting the past, I'm just saying that's where we have to go in the future. And Thea, you work in education, and what is your experience? I'm curious about this. I'm curious about some of the issues involving religious symbols in education. Are they not allowing any religious symbols now? I've heard these debates, like you can wear a Star of David, but you can't wear a pentacle, or you can wear a cross, and you can't wear this. And if you do know of that, I'm curious about religious freedom in schools, because I think the Constitution was written in a way as to say that it's okay to pray in school, but it just means that the government can't tell you who to pray to, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's actually, that's kind of how I read it, too. I mean, my understanding is what it's mostly supposed to be is that the school is not supposed to sponsor or the school is not
promote
supposed to
promote or whatever.
They're not supposed to shove religion down your throat. It doesn't mean you can't pray in your study hall or whatever. Nobody's going to stop you from doing that. Regarding the symbols, it's really interesting. You know, it really varies from school to school, area to area, state to state. One of the kind of interesting connections that I've seen is that sometimes the religious symbols are banned not because they're religious symbols so much as because they're considered to be affiliated with gang activity. Sometimes pentacles, but even images, particularly in California, of the Virgin of Guadalupe, who's, you know, sometimes interestingly associated with certain gang activity, which is kind of weird to me, but whatever. Anyway, I think it's still really tough being a pagan kid in school, but I also think there are places where it's getting better, and little stories popping up here and there that give us some hope. But the rules about it are really inconsistent, so it's hard to make a blanket statement.
There was the case in Michigan where the girl was bullied. Now, I actually think she was just – it was more bullying, and I'm not sure or convinced that she was totally bullied just because of being Wiccan. But she was bullied, and she committed suicide. And in that case, again – I do think, though, that some things could have been helped, as Reverend Don said. Maybe it couldn't have stopped. Maybe it was something beyond that. I'm just throwing that out there, that it could have been something beyond that, but it could have been helped at least by the fact that if more education was out there about pagan religions, that the bullying maybe would have not been so easily engaged in. And what I'm going to do here is switch the topic up now a little bit, as we're coming down to about 20 minutes left. And it's been a great conversation. Thank you both for showing up, by the way. And I want to ask of Reverend Don, is there something new right now, or something brand new, a project or anything that you wish to plug, or anything?
Well, you know, I would mainly plug the things that I've been doing for a long time, witchpool.com, tarotcollege.com, pagantonightradio.com, and of course my Monday night chat room, every Monday night at 8 Central.
And every once in a while, you just say Main Street Universe, right? I'm playing.
Yes.
But I heard you say us on Thursday. I tuned in for a minute. That's why I was playing and saying that. But go ahead, Reverend Dunn. Yes, Reverend Dunn is, I will say it myself. I will plug his things. He's also a visual artist. I've seen some of the little dolls you created and your drawings. You seem to have a great visual sensibility.
Thank you.
And you as well have a website, Witch School International, as well as you do readings. So if you want to promote that, please tell people where they can get a reading from Reverend Don Lewis.
Well, if anyone would be interested in a reading, I do readings, and you can book one through witchschoolstore.com. And I do tarot, I do clairvoyance, I do past life readings, and in person I can also do past life regressions.
Hmm. I would actually like that at some point. Cool. I'm going to give you some business at some point in the near future.
That would be wonderful.
And I will pay for it because I want to support you, because I think pagans should support each other. And should support, you know, if you have a little business going on, there's so many great New Age shops closing. You know, it's just, excuse me, I have to calm down because it upsets me.
Yeah.
I just recently found out that my favorite one in Baltimore closed down. Ooh. And I didn't even know it was, and it had been closed down for 2 years. And,
oh, my goodness.
It was a big old coffee shop. It had yoga studios. They did kung fu and tai chi, and they had coffee and food and everything else, and they had more business than just the metaphysical stuff. So I thought
the fall of the economy has been as bad for our community as for others.
Yes, it's true.
The other thing that sometimes happens is that a lot of times our people go into things without really thinking about them in a practical way. There are a lot of people who will open that metaphysical shop because they've always wanted to,
yes,
but they don't stop to ask themselves if they know how to run it or, yeah. And so naturally it will go for a little while as long as they can support it and then not.
And I've met many people in that boat.
Yeah. But with the economy having done what it did, even many very well-run ones that had had good, steady business were still challenged severely in terms of ability to survive.
And you're with the right now reading with the old occult bookstore in Chicago, right?
Yes, every Friday afternoon I read at the occult bookstore, which I believe is the oldest metaphysical bookstore in the country and one of the oldest in the world.
And that's why I wanted to bring that up, because I think that store, it's still surviving. I think it had to change locations quite a few times, but it's still still going.
It has changed locations several times, and it's changed owners, because the person who founded it, of course, is long in spirit now.
Right.
But it keeps going because people consider it important, and they have done what was needed to keep it going. And it is an example, I think an example to us all, that we can keep our metaphysical community strong and surviving from generation to generation if we are determined and if we're willing to do the things that are necessary.
Yeah, because that is...
Yeah,
go ahead, Thea.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think we have one in my local area, and I think that one of the reasons why it's still there is exactly what Don was just talking about, is, you know, folks making a point of going there and getting what they need rather than just ordering it online because it's easier, or, you know, just actually making a point of saying, hey, we're going to support this because this supports our community.
Yeah. And your point is great, because so many people do not realize that they think, oh, the neighborhood shop is quaint, but they won't do anything to actually support it. And I'm not trying to be preachy or weird, or I'm just being very real.
Mm-hmm.
And when you...
I think another important thing when you're running that kind of shop is that you have to realize your competition, and you have to ask yourself what you can offer that they cannot. And sometimes you have to change some of the things that you're doing, and you have to be flexible enough to do that. The other thing is I don't think it's really possible to have a successful metaphysical store today without an online branch.
And without something else. My idea of the... I'm an electrician, and I'll tell you what my model is. That it doesn't exist yet, and I don't necessarily have the funds yet, but we will see how all this works out. My model is that I plan on, because I don't want to bring it up because I don't want to bring up a sore spot, you know, the World of Witches Museum. I thought it was such a beautiful thing, and I love seeing your online classes and your online, you know, Joseph Campbell study groups. And what I also loved about it was there were young people, you know. So a lot of people think of pagan stuff and they go to these older intellectuals, and I love seeing the young people involved. But what is important to me is that I think, like you said, it needs another stream of income, basically. It basically needs something else. And mine is I'm an electrician, so I was like, well, I'll do some electrical work, I'll run a shop, I'll do this, I'll do that, maybe do some readings for money, do whatever. Whatever takes music, of course, because I'm a musician, so whatever it takes to create and maintain something like that.
Mm-hmm. And well, that's what you have to do. You have to do whatever it takes. And that's true whether you're running a store or a group or a tradition, or really even just your own life, because it isn't always going to be what you abstractly expected or imagined. And to go back to a point I hit much earlier, you have to focus on function more than form, because that beautiful form isn't really beautiful if it doesn't serve the function.
Yeah, and it's an interesting way to see things, because I know people that were very dreamy and they just sort of thought they were going to open something up and just do one or two things and thought it was going to work. And when it did not, they were very surprised. So you have to view it in a multi... Basically, my whole point is that you have to view it from a multifaceted sensibility. And you have to view it as, to me, I even was joking around with somebody the other day where I said, oh, I'll open up a casino. In the back of the casino will be a New Age shop and a temple. I'm not necessarily sure of the morals of that. I, of course, don't have the money for that right now, but I'm just saying.
Well, the Catholic Church has made a great deal of has had a great deal of success with bingo.
So that's gambling. There you go.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like a Catholic
and,
right now.
Well, you know,
of course, one
is,
of our... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You have to look at what the successful models are.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to look at your own model and say, you know, this isn't working the way I want it to. I need to make changes. And you have to be flexible enough to be willing to do that, at least to those things that are reasonable to change.
Yeah. I agree completely. And one thing I would like to do is to, we have a few minutes left. I know, Thea, you're still there. We haven't forgotten you now. She hasn't been quite as vocal, but that's okay. It's not her show, and she's, you know, one of the guests. It is down to now me, Don, and Thea, by the way, in case anybody is wondering. It's down to that. Janice had to leave, but I still have people that live here that I had to escape from occasionally. And how about a reading? I am going to. Reverend Don, would you like a reading? I have my tarot deck in front of me.
Sure.
So I shall do a reading. I just bought a new deck. And it's, I don't know if you're familiar with this deck. It's, or maybe you are, I'm just saying I'm not sure. It's the Halloween deck by Kipling West.
I think that I have seen that one. It was very cute.
It's a very quirky, cute deck. And today I bought a funny... I felt as if the cloth that it should be red on, or its home cloth, should be something very sort of earthy and grounded. So I sort of went out and very affordably, about $5, bought a cloth that's actually very pretty brown cloth. Janice was very impressed by it. Because when you hold it up to the light, you see these like patterns, but in the background, it doesn't really look like that much. So I thought, well, cartoonish, fun, quirky, gothic deck, and grounded, sort of brown, earthy cloth, I thought would be a good balance.
Yes,
so what I would do is that here's how it would be, Reverend Don, if it was anybody. And if we have time, Thea, as well, of course. I would divide the cards. I would shuffle them very quickly. And I'm going to do this quick shuffle. And now with your participation, Reverend Don, I am now shuffling, and I want you to tell me when to stop.
Stop.
Okay. One fell out, and in my rule, one falls away. That means they're, like, screaming to me. So I just go ahead and go with them.
I do
but
that.
Here are the three cards that I have for you. The first one, this is an interesting, very interesting reading in some ways, and very proper, I think, for someone head of a spiritual tradition, as all the two first two cards are very much higher arcana. And the first one is the Empress. This, to me, right now I'll move on and then tell you what they all three mean to me. Right now, this means to me, you are someone who births things or you know, creates things. This is the creator. This is the Empress. The second card is the Moon reversed. This is telling me that there is something or someone that's not right with your intuitive wisdom. The Moon is the... But intuitive wisdom is still present, as it is the Moon card. And there's something not exactly right, but the end of this is the Queen of Pentacles. So I do see some prosperity, but with some struggle. Doesn't mean, reverse doesn't mean necessarily, as you may already know, bad. It just means there's something interfering, something, you know, some struggle, some bad things, but I definitely see the end of this being just as a general message from the universe that the Queen of Pumpkins the Halloween deck, the Queen of Pentacles will return. There is a return of abundance here, but there was something, the only thing bothering me about these three cards is, and I'm just going to say it intuitively without the cards, I'm thinking that were you going through any kind of time where you were maybe, I don't want to say this in the wrong way, not trusting certain intuitive messages. We all do this. We've all been through this. You know, this is a time of go ahead and trust the intuitive messages. Don't think that they're... I mean, question, of course.
Yeah.
But that's what it's saying to me. With the Queen of Moon... With the I'm sorry, not the Queen of Moon, the Moon reverse. There was some sort of intuitive thing that maybe you were questioning. That's what I get from that.
Okay.
But I do see success beyond that. With the Queen of Pentacles, Queen of Coins.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I hope it applies. You didn't respond.
I think it probably does.
And because you are in, and here's what I'm getting from this also, you are in a position that's dramatically different from me. So here's exactly also what I'm getting from this, is that you are in a position where people look to you because you're chancellor. So there's going to sometimes be times when you think, oh, you know, what if I say the wrong thing? It's on, you know, it's on the internet, it's on the video. You know what I mean? It's intuitive wisdom being shared around the world. And what if I, you know, gosh, what if I goof it up, you know? And according to my reading, of course, you'll be fine. But that's what I'm getting from it. That's what I'm getting from these cards, is I'm getting that the only negative is that a little bit insecurity that anyone should have, in my opinion, in your position. So, but again, in the end, it seems, at least temporarily, to work out.
Well, good.
And Thea Sabin.
Here it works out.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a tough place to be. You know, you're part of a minority tradition, a pagan tradition, and people ask them questions and everything else. So, of course, the moon reversed is, in between those cards, is what insecurity may I have about sharing that. Now, at the end, it all works out in that reading, and he's wise, and I've listened to his e-logs, and I know he's great. And but that's always something that someone would think in that position in mind. Yeah, David, I'm shuffling. Tell me when to stop.
Stop.
Okay. And I shall pick three piles. Pick from one, two, or three.
Two.
Okay. One or three?
Three.
Okay. And we know what the final is. Okay. Well, your reading is actually pretty good. It ends with the Page of Wands. I'm running out of time here, so I have to shorten it. It's the King of Wands reversed, meaning something, maybe it wasn't working so well before, but then the next card is the Star. And the Star tells me, you know, it's a great wish come true card. It's just a beautiful card. And there's new information coming to you involving your projects and success that you've been working so hard on. It's going to happen sometime within the next few months, I think, according to this reading. If not, come back and yell at me, but I think sometime within a few months. But it means, and it needs your effort, and it needs your constantness, your exhaustion, basically. But it's showing me that some, or what you consider failure in the past, I was getting the impression it was a general message, but I'm getting the impression, and I could be wrong, that this is about, you know, your career and stuff you've been working on, and is what was on your mind. And it seems sometime within a few months there might be some sort of progression or change. It could be even just being on the show, perhaps, could spark something. We get more listeners than people think. We get a lot of archive listeners. So I think it's going to be okay. Go ahead and charge forward. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Reverend Don Lewis.
Thank you.
And thank you, Thea Sabin.
Thank you.
And I'm going to go ahead and end this with a song. I'm going to go ahead and go with our friend Kellyanna, who we had on the show before. And the song is Mother Love Me.
Mother, help me. Mother, heal me. Please release me from all things worldly that do not serve me. Mother, love me. Mother, help me. Mother, heal me. Please release me from all things worldly that do not serve me. Mother, love me.
When
Mother,
in these tones I feel
Mother,
the power,
me.
I
please
am
reborn
me as I break
from
these
all things
chains
worldly,
that bind. And
I
now I'm floating light as a feather.
That's okay. I want to thank you both for showing up this evening.
Thank you, Brent.
Thank you.
I hope the conversation went okay. It went well. We had a few issues where there was people coming in and out, and there was some people eating dinner upstairs and making noise, and which was fine, but that's what happens from time to time. So I want to thank you very much for coming out and joining us. And
thanks for having us.
Yeah, I hope everybody had a chance to plug everything. I forgot. I think I said to let you plug everything. I hope I did. If not, I will do it in the future on the or if you know what I mean, on the Main Street Universe homepage or the Facebook page or something like that. We actually get a surprising amount of views. It didn't look as much. I was expecting a more active chat room. I was expecting some of the people from Pagans Tonight, as we have a lot of shared listeners, I was expecting some of them, but it happens that way. But sometimes a lot of the listens are in the archives. Actual numbers are, like, for example, Pagans Tonight gets, Ed told me something like, and we're talking in private now, I think. Let me press edit end episode to make sure.